Kia ora tātou and welcome to the next episode of Michael and Deborah Have a Chat, which is our excellently named chat series. We're pretty excited tonight because we have with us Minister James Shaw from the Green Party, but James is the Minister of Climate Change and he's just had a major achievement in getting the zero carbon bill through the House. So we're really pleased to have you here, James.
Thank you. Yeah, cool. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, yeah. So the zero carbon bill. Tell us about it. What does it do?
Yeah, so the zero carbon, it's actually an amendment to an existing piece of legislation called the Climate Change Response Act 2002. And what it does is it provides an overlay to that piece of legislation and says, well, actually, what is the purpose of our climate change legislation? And that's to hold New Zealand within the envelope of 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming above pre-industrial levels. And that really was clarified last year when the big UN report came out saying if we go north of 1.5 degrees, I mean actually if we go to 1.5 degrees we're going to be in a lot of trouble, but if we go north of that we're going to be in really deep trouble. So that's kind of the main thing. Then it sets up an independent climate change commission to help depoliticize climate change policy over the next three decades. It lays out some pretty tough targets for what we need to do with our own greenhouse gas emissions over that period of time, and it also sets up a requirement on the government to have a plan for how we adapt to the effects of climate change.
So nothing much then.
Yeah. I have to say, on the night that it was being passed, I had this quite a famous clip from the United States when Obama passed the Affordable Health Care Act, and it's of Joe Biden whispering to him, and I suspect Biden was kind of knew that someone was listening in, saying, you know, this is a really big flaming deal. And that's kind of how I felt on that night, that we had this world leading piece of legislation, pretty much political consensus around it as well. Did you, at the beginning of this parliamentary term, did you think we'd get there?
Yes.
That sounds very qualified.
Well, that was just, I think, probably a naive view, because there were plenty of moments during the course of the last 2 years when I didn't think that we were going to get there. I mean, obviously we always had the numbers in the House to pass it, but to me it was absolutely critical that we got the opposition on board, because there are going to be multiple changes of government over the next 30 years. The investment community and businesses actually need a level of predictability, and they were really strongly saying, look, this has got to have bipartisan support, because we need to know what the parameters are that we're operating in. And so when it passed unopposed, actually, that was actually a better result than I had ever anticipated at any point. Actually, I always thought it would go to a party vote. And right up until the very last minute, I just didn't know whether or not we had the opposition on board. So I was delighted when they did.
Mm. Yes, I sat and listened through your speech as at the start of the third reading, which is a great speech. The leader of the opposition stood up, and I thought, this is it, this is when we get to know what's going to happen. Did you know before then, or
No, I had a sense that we were probably okay, but I didn't know for sure. They'd had a caucus meeting at 9 p.m. the previous night after the Committee of the Whole House stage had gone through, and of course we had not supported any of their amendments, and I thought, well, that actually does give them an excuse not to vote for the bill if they wanted it. But they ultimately, I think that they looked at it in the round and said, actually, we've got most of what we wanted. We didn't get everything we wanted, but neither did anybody else, and came down on the right side of history.
I mean, obviously, in this place, all of our parties make political judgments at times about the things that we support, and there are a whole lot of things that weigh into that. But do you also think that there was a public mood shift which contributed to the fact that we got consensus across the House?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know what you think, but you know, when we came into government, I think that we were probably slightly ahead of public opinion when it came to climate change policy. And about a year later, we were behind public opinion. You know, it was just it moved so rapidly, and I think that UN report on 1.5 was a big part of that. The school strikes, which kind of came off the back of that, were massive. And off the back of the school strikes, you had organisations like Million Mothers popping up and so on. And actually, I kind of think that we've almost been kind of caught going on. Almost not fast enough, right? Yeah. So I think that massively helped.
I think the critical thing there, I thought, was the 170,000 people in the streets.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that was amazing that many people turning out to support real action on climate change. But, you know, I don't know how any political party could look at 170,000 people in the streets. It's what, 3% of New Zealand's population or something like that?
Yeah.
And so how many more behind them? People who would have liked to have been there but weren't able to be at the process that day or said, yep, I support this.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. And I was talking to, you know, some of the people who have been around this place for a lot longer who said that in their time, they hadn't seen anything like it since the anti-nuclear protests of the 1980s, 30 years ago.
Right, yeah.
Maybe the foreshore and seabed Hikoi, which was confined to Wellington at that time, but had a sort of a similar presence out the front.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, they just couldn't remember anything in three decades that even came close to those numbers.
And see, that was out the front of Parliament here. That's and of course Queen Street was full as well, and there were marches. I was in Tauranga that day, and a huge number of people turned out in Tauranga. It was massive.
It clearly resonated. And that did, you know, put a lot of emphasis behind what we were doing.
Stiffened the resolve of people who knew this had to happen, and perhaps made some of those people who are wavering a bit think a little bit.
But
I suppose something that worries me a little bit is that having passed the Zero Carbon Bill, which is, it's the Zero Carbon Act now, isn't it?
Well, it's actually now the Climate Change Response Act 2002.
Oh, indeed it is.
Because it's sort of been assimilated within
Let's keep on calling it the Zero Carbon one. That people will think, right, job done.
And that all that did is get us to the start line.
Yeah. Okay.
I know it feels like a lot of work, right? But no, it did. It is literally just about saying, okay, we know where we need to go. Let's get started.
Yeah. So it's probably a good time to talk a little bit actually about some of the mechanisms in there and kind of what we're setting ourselves up for, because, you know, the end game is zero carbon by 2050. So we're setting up an infrastructure to get us through the next, 31 years?
Yeah, that's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about the actual mechanisms in the bill that help us get from where we are now?
Yeah.
Which has been, you know, since 1990, effectively a collective failure to hold emissions down to a point where we bring them from where they are to net zero. Because that's a big job. So can we talk through the mechanisms there that are going to...
It is a big job. It's also made harder by the fact, as you say, that we haven't made a lot of progress in the last 30 years. And so every year that we leave it, you know, the remaining job just gets harder and harder, you know, that curve gets steeper. So I guess there's a few main things. So the really big thing is this independent climate change commission, modeled on something very similar in the UK, which has been very successful. It's a group of experts who are independent of, you know, the political process, whose job it is to take the best science and economics and so on, and to say, well, here is where you need to get to. We've got that target in the legislation. Their job is to come up with a series of 5-year kind of stepping stone emissions budgets to say, in this 5-year period, you're allowed in total to emit this amount of greenhouse gas. In the period after, it'll be less than that, and so on. So it's a sort of a series of interim targets, if you like. And those 5-year emissions budgets will then inform the emissions trading scheme and how many units we're allowed to, you know, have going on, and
which will then feed into the cost.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Which is supply and demand, right?
Yeah.
And so what will happen ultimately, and this is a second set of reforms, is that we'll have a cap in the emissions trading scheme that will sink down as well, and so the amount that you're allowed to pollute will just get lower and lower and lower every year, and those are kind of the main things. Yeah,
but there's plans in there too, so that you can the commission will recommend to government not what target they should, but how they should do it.
Yeah, that's right. So in the UK, their first emissions budget, the commission said, look, you've got to get your carbon dioxide down pretty dramatically, and they said in the first, I think, two periods, the first 10 years, focus on taking the coal-fired electricity generation out and replacing it with renewables. That was the kind of thing that was lowest cost, easiest to do, the technology existed, And the UK's done that, and they've been tremendously successful. Of course, the you know, you do the so-called, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't easy to take all of that, you know, coal fighter generation out, but it was easier than the other options. Now, of course, that they've done most of that,
they're into the hard bit.
Yeah. And in some ways that's where we're at. But we will probably end up focusing on things like transport, where similarly to the UK, it's frankly we've got the technology, you know, we know what the cost is, you know, it's not in the grand scheme of things not that hard to do.
But it can be done.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think so. This is what I feel so hopeful about this is climate change feels like a huge threat, and it is a huge threat, but at last we can start actually doing stuff.
So if we look at a sector like transport, and I think it's second biggest after agriculture collectively, what does that actually sort of look like, say, over the next 10 or 15 years in terms of the kind of decisions that central government might make, local government might make, people in the private sector might make? How does that begin to influence?
Well, it's interesting. While the bill was still going through the House, there's this group of businesses called the Climate Leaders Coalition. They got a group of chief executives from the transport and freight sector together in a room for a day and said, okay, you've got to cut your carbon dioxide emissions in half in 10 years. What's your plan? Right? And so that they've got companies, you know, in there that are, you know, companies like, you know, Toyota and so on, who actually supply vehicles. You've also got companies like, say, you know, Main Freight, who are, you know, logistics company who use vehicles. You had public transport agencies and so on. And so they're all sitting there going, okay, well, how are we going to adjust this? But I think the kinds of things that you'll see are, as you know, we've got some stuff coming through the pipeline, and we're intending to introduce a clean car discount to make low emission and zero emission vehicles cheaper and more easier for people to buy. We're introducing tailpipe emission standards. We're one of only two countries in the OECD that doesn't have them yet.
What?
I know.
Okay.
Us in Russia, I think. And so on. We've actually, so there's those sort of things. I think it'll help local governments to sort of go, okay, you know, the next bus we buy shouldn't be a diesel, it should be an electric or a hydrogen based bus. How do we make those kinds of things? I think you'll see investment start to shift. In fact, a couple of days ago, Mercury said that they are going to build the country's largest wind farm just outside of Palmerston North. And they had already decided to build half of it, but after the Act passed, unopposed in the House, their board said, oh, let's do the other half.
So there's something there about the regulatory certainty
that
helps those decisions.
That's right. Yeah, they're like, okay, well, clearly that's the direction of travel. You know, let's go for it.
Yeah, great. Can you tell us a little bit about the targets and how they'll work? Because that's been one of the things which has been a bit politically contested. Can you talk to us about the targets that are in the bill and how they interact with the role that the Independent Climate Change Commission will take?
Yeah, so by setting the targets into primary legislation, which we've never done before, we've had targets, they just haven't been legislated for, is we're saying... Parliament has said this is the goal, and then the Commission's job is really to advise us on how to get to that goal. The target is set at the year 2050. I imagine that as we get closer to the year 2050, probably Parliaments then will want to set them a bit further out as well. But what we've said is that we want all gases except for biogenic methane to be at what we call net zero. So that means you take it down as low as you possibly can, and that anything that's remaining you have to offset with things like forestry. And that's got to be down at zero by 2050. And then for biogenic methane, which is basically animal agriculture, that's got to come down by 10% in the next 10 years, so about 1% a year on average, and then somewhere between 24 and 47% by the year 2050. And the reason why there's a range there is because we couldn't get really clear scientific advice about what that needed to be whilst we were putting the bill together. So one of the things that we've built into the bill is a requirement for the new commission to revise that and come back to Parliament and say, actually, there's a more definitive number.
So it's a holding range.
Yeah, essentially. It was sort of provisional because we needed to set a direction of travel. But we were just getting basically wildly contradictory advice, and so we said, okay, well, let's just take what the UN says needs to be the range and sort of go, well, that's somewhere in there as we were aiming for. But now that we've got the commission, we're about to get it up and running, they will be able to provide us with a view of what that needs to be.
It's very exciting.
I think so.
You sort of think, well, of the work that's been done for years and years and years by pressure groups and by environmental groups, and it culminates in this bill, which creates a roadmap for us.
I don't think that you can underestimate how significant that is, right? Because climate policy in New Zealand has been pretty contentious. And it is contentious in other countries, and you know, you look to our nearest neighbour, Australia, where it's a
they're not so clear at the moment.
Frankly, it's a disaster for them. So you kind of look at that and go, okay, well, you know, we need something a bit clearer. And actually, this is, you know, we are one of about a dozen countries in the world that has any form of primary legislation around climate change.
Right.
We are one of the first countries to put that 1.5 degree target into legislation. We're not the first, but we're one of the leading countries in the world on this now, and that is really exciting.
One of the things I've been thinking about this, and it follows on from the discussion we had last month, is sometimes when we're talking about this, we talk about the fact that we need to depoliticise the science around things, but actually the process around this bill has actually been a case of democratic politics working, not just parliamentary politics, but actually citizens engaging, organising, putting pressure on, politicians responding to that, building consensus. It's actually kind of how things are supposed to work if you have a healthy democracy. So I think that's a thing that you should feel good about. But I think all those thousands of people who marched, the Generation Zero activists who years ago started talking about this, it's a neat story, I reckon, actually.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I have to say that there were times when I thought the political process was going to derail the whole thing. But actually, you're right. Ultimately, it worked. And it would not have worked if it wasn't for all of those organisations and those people who did put just an enormous amount of effort into making sure that we did our job.
But also, I think too, you built some critical personal relationships in Parliament with people particularly from the National Party. So you sat and negotiated in really good faith with them, and I think that has helped as well. So it's obviously the triumph of all the people who marched in the streets and the Generation Zero one, but very much yours as well.
Yeah, look, I always believe that there's a different way to do politics from the version of politics that we see on the television.
So much question time.
Just the worst example of it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, my view is that if you make a genuine offer and you are prepared to negotiate in good faith, and you genuinely listen to people's concerns, and if you're kind of far away on things, that you work to find something that will kind of be enough for people, then, you know, most of the time that will work.
And it did.
So,
you know, great climate change policy, but actually great process.
Politics can work.
It's a cheerful note, isn't it?
It is. Very quickly before we do finish off, what's next?
Well,
get on the back, have a beer. What do you do now?
So on the day that we did the second reading of the Zero Carbon Bill, we also did the first reading of the Emissions Trading Reform Bill. Now that is actually an enormous piece of work. The Zero Carbon Bill was about 40 pages long, roughly. It's not a very big piece of legislation. The Emissions Trading Reform Bill is 10 times the length, right? There were about 19 cabinet papers that informed it, and 19 regulatory impact statements that go with those. And it's hugely technical. So the idea is that we've got the target, you know, the emissions budgets, we've got the commission, but the primary tool that we've got of how to shift emissions is the emissions trading scheme. It has not worked. The settings in there have not actually led to lower emissions. And we need to tighten it up. Now, that piece of work was actually started off by the previous national government, they did a review, they got a pretty clear signal about what wasn't working. Their cabinet made some in-principle decisions, and then we inherited a work program that was essentially already in train. But it has been massive. So we sort of picked that ball kind of when we came into government. But it's been an enormous amount of work, and we've got to get that through by about the middle of next year, because we're going to move to start auctioning ETS units and all of that kind of stuff, and we've got to put that cap in. It's a cap and trade system with no cap, so we're doing that. So that's what's next.
Go well, James.
Thank you. Thanks. You too.
Yeah.
Let's keep it up.
Cool. All right. I think that's us. Thanks for watching, folks, and we'll be back again next month.
Ka kite anō.